You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, can Catalonia be governed from Belgium? Or, for that matter, from prison? My guests Chris Lord, Henry Reece Sheridan, Chiara Ramella and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what we learned at the Modern Magazine conference, whether it is past time that regulation caught up with social media giants, and is any tin of pasta worth $110, even if it does come with an apron? Indeed, is any apron worth $110, even if it comes with a tin of pasta? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today, at least for the first bit, are Monocle's Chris Lord, Chiara Ramella, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome all. And let's start by taking a look at what has been an eventful week in the genesis of what still hopes to become Europe's newest nation. Catalonia's procession to independence is not going, it is fair to say, smoothly. Eight of the regional government's recently dismissed ministers have appeared in court, charged with rebellion, sedition, and misuse of public funds. Catalonia's former president, Carles Puigdemont, remains in self-imposed exile in Belgium, while Spanish prosecutors seek a European warrant for his arrest, along with four other ministers yet to come home. Chris, first of all, are we witnessing a plan coming together here, or has it all gone somewhat askew?
Well, I think in one sense we can say that if we think back just maybe 12 months ago, did you know really that much about Carl Puigdemont? Did you know really that much about who he was and who his cabinet were and all this sort of thing and how far they were prepared to go? So I think in one sense, the sort of sense of creating a platform for themselves by hook or by crook is working. They are getting press conferences there in Belgium. People, the world's media is listening to them. And they are in many ways getting exactly what they want in terms of the kind of coverage that they're after. But I think as you know, that whole list of situations that they face now, I mean, you know, Puigdemont is, if this arrest warrant does happen, he is going to be picked up by Belgian police quite promptly. At the same time, we're going to see where if these elections do go ahead in December on the 21st, is there really going to be a secession party going to be running in those elections? So has the legitimate voice of a process in Spain towards some sort of succession kind of come to a halt? It kind of seems that way, really, doesn't it? But at the same time, I think we have to remember that they have underlined their cause in a way that if it had gone much more smoothly and kind of fizzled out, then it wouldn't have been. It's drama and people are listening to them.
Chiara, as Chris correctly points out, Mr. Puigdemont has succeeded in getting his name in the papers, but has he undermined his position by doing a runner?
Well, I don't think so, unless you think of him in the same ilk of somebody. I think we don't need to think that leaders need to be at front and center of the army, as it were, in their home ground, and you can think of him as a figure who is making the most of the media exposure that he can still garner in Belgium for now, and perhaps also just avoiding a series of circumstances that would exacerbate the situation if he did stay in Catalonia.
Fernando, what would be the smart move for Mr. Puigdemont now? If we assume that the Spanish government, or the Spanish prosecutors rather, will get this warrant for his arrest that they seek, does he wait it out for as long as he can? Does he return to Spain of his own volition to face the music? Does he buy a sleeping bag and head for the nearest Ecuadorian embassy?
Well, I think it's a difficult one to say, but I hope, you know, he can come back to Spain at some point without getting arrested. But, I don't know the latest details. And of course, as you guys mentioned, there will be regional elections in Spain on the 21st of December. And I hope his party will be there as well. I think it would be very damaging for the Spanish democracy if one of the parties boycotted this election. Because I think the result of this election will be essential. Because if they win, you know, then you will see that there is a case to have an official referendum for Catalonia independence. But if they lose, perhaps you know, this might not be needed in some ways as well.
Chris, there's kind of a local to us, that is, resonance to this story, which is, of course, that the United Kingdom has, though it seems an awful lot longer ago than just a couple of years, has had a not dissimilar referendum, which was, of course, the official legal referendum on Scottish independence, which was narrowly defeated. The response to the Catalonian thing from the Scottish National Party has been interestingly muted, hasn't it? You would have expected them to be all yay Catalonia, go 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 Catalonia, we recognise Catalonia, and yet they've sort of tended to look the other way when asked the question.
They have. I mean, they have to do, really, because First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, she's in a bit of a bind, really, and kind of caught between two things. On one side, yes, ideologically they should support Catalonia's independence because it very much feeds into their own narrative about what Scotland could do, in as much as, oh, you know, if we were independent we could be super power, you know, it's a very productive new nation, we want to be internationalist and da-da, but we also want to assert ourselves as our own culture. But on the other side of things here, the reality is that the European Union's own muted response to what's happened in Catalonia kind of shows that if you do decide to declare yourself an independent nation and decide to go ahead and have referendums like this that are unconstitutional, that you're not going to really get the support of the EU for it. And that therefore opens the ground, of course, to the possibility that if you do break away and secede, you may not get into the Union, which is what she's promised. You know, we went throughout that whole referendum period when Scotland had its referendum. They kept saying, oh, if we break away, and in fact now with the whole Brexit thing back on the table,
it could yet happen.
It could yet happen. And but also one of the key things that she said throughout is we want to have an indie ref too, because now our relationship with the EU has changed and we want to remain part of the European Union. But actually what we're seeing here is that if you do secede and become a province, an independent nation, it might not happen. They might not be behind you.
Kiara, do you think that might skew the vote on December 21st? I guess the dose of reality that has been introduced to the debate, where we've seen it made fairly clear that an independent Catalonia would be outside the EU, that it would not be recognised by any other country, I guess with the possible exception of Russia if they were trying to be funny, and that large numbers of employers would leave. In fact, several already have.
I think perhaps the fact that this enters the European consciousness at a time after something like Brexit has happened, and that we have seen that a series of votes of independence do have a practical consequence also on countries' economies, because that's another factor that's also been cited about Catalonia, that from a nation that is well off within Spain's remit.
It
probably wouldn't be able to sustain it if it did go independent, at least with the terms that we are detailing right now. And I think that consciousness, and what perhaps I'm being a little bit UK-centric here, but I think with the consciousness of something that has happened, for example, to the UK right now, is happening in the UK right now, it does put a little bit of a perspective and out of a reality check on the fact that these consequences do exist and they do happen, and they are not just the act of scarecrows who are trying to convince people to stay together within an union. There is an actual serious and practical economic consequence to these decisions.
There is, of course, a certain amount of this sort of sentiment in your home country of Italy. There is almost none of it in mine in Australia, though there is occasional talk about people wanting the north of Queensland to become a separate state, though the reasons for that are beyond me. Is there much of this kind of thing in Brazil, Fernando?
No, I think it's a bit like in Australia. I think the south of Brazil, again, the richest region, they wanted to secede from Brazil for a while, but of course they were not successful. But there's been some talk here and there, but nothing special in particular.
Well, on that, hopefully, Unitarian, that's not the right word, that's a religious denomination, but you know what I'm saying. Let's move along. This week just past has seen the staging here in London of the Modern Magazine Conference, which is, as the name strongly suggests, a conference concerning modern magazines. Kiara and Fernando attended, of which more shortly, but we have also seen recently a couple of hugely dispiriting media stories. There has been the abrupt closure of DNA Info and Gothamist by their billionaire owner Joe Ricketts, and the demise of the print edition of Teen Vogue, among other cutbacks at Condé Nast. Let's talk about the Modern Magazine conference first, though. Fernando, what did we learn?
Well, we learned that actually it's not all bad for the publishing industry in some ways. Cool, we've heard Teen Vogue close down. And, I mean, it's a shame. I think every magazine that closed down for me is a shame. But also we have new titles coming up. And as Jeremy Leslie, the organizer of the conference, said yesterday, actually news magazines, the circulation have been rising. So I find this fascinating. I found it was quite an upbeat conference as well.
Was that your sense of it, Chiara? Are you going to disagree violently with Fernando here and sort of generate some controversy?
No,
did you find it incredibly downheartening and dispiriting?
No, I think there was something that was said that particularly resonated with me, which was by the co-founder of Moshpit magazine, which is, yes, some magazines do close, but sometimes magazines close simply because they have lost their relevance. They just can't keep going because they don't have the bones to do so, and the relentlessness and difficulty of the atmosphere at the moment only exacerbates this problem, and therefore perhaps hurries along magazines that don't necessarily have legs to stand on. And I think we need to take that into consideration, that it can also be an interesting time for people to show really what they're made of.
All right, Fernando, what did people feel about the future of print advertising? Because this is usually where people start getting somewhat anxious. And, well, I get anxious and nervous about online advertising as well, but people get especially anxious and nervous about the future of print advertising.
Well, I've been to another conference this year earlier on, the FIP, which, you know, all the major media players in the magazine industry were there as well. Of course, there are concerns, but to be honest, the online advertising is definitely not catching up with the print advertising. Even though print advertising is going down, it's still the king in some ways, because it's very difficult to make money with online advertising. So there is pressure, of course, on print, but there is a future there, and I think you can prove with the numbers, because circulation rising in a time where people are saying print is dead, I think it's quite surprising, and it makes me smile. But yeah, the challenges are there, of course.
What's really interesting is something that the editor of It's Nice That actually said, which is they have a huge, huge online readership. Like, combining all of their platform, they reach about a million people. And yet, they still decide to print their printed version, which is called Printed Pages. And that has only a printed run of about 5,000-6,000 copies. And he gets asked a lot, why do you bother doing it? Because obviously it's reaching a fraction of the audience that you get online. And his answer is basically because it still makes money.
It's a committed audience who goes there and buy a product instead of just browsing quickly. You know, it's not that we are here against online. I think we should collaborate. But yeah, I think ads on print are much more, efficient in some ways.
We have seamlessly swapped out during that discussion Chris Lord for Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you like, I can pantomime a Northern accent and pretend to be Chris Lord, or I can just assume my own persona.
Well, you have already now blown your cover. If you were going to do the Chris Lord voice, that would have been the time to do it. We just could have maintained the deception.
I just thought I'd give you the option, Andrew.
In fact, we should start encouraging our listeners in the belief that we're none of us are really here, and that just every week we're all just doing impersonations of each other. It is now the time to reveal that these last few years there haven't been any other guests on the Monocle Daily at all. It's just me doing all the voices. That's a weird thought. Maybe I should try to do that one evening and see if anybody notices. I feel we are.
What would be weird if you were having this conversation with yourself on air now?
Well, people don't.
People don't know, do they?
People don't know that I'm not. We are deviating somewhat from the point here. Henry, we should talk about the abrupt shuttering of DNA Info and Gothamist. 115 jobs lost. Two absolutely excellent websites. Does this appear to be as petty as it looks, which is that the staff were warned not to unionise or they'd all get fired? They then decided to unionise and they all got fired.
I don't know about the spreadsheet of these businesses or Ricketts business in general. Obviously, the decision by the staff to unionise seems to have been an exacerbating factor. And I think a representative of Ricketts said that, you know, it was not a deciding factor, but yet another barrier to making the business viable, which, you know, I'm not personally positioned in a place to contest that. I imagine it would probably make a business which already has quite narrow margins a little bit trickier to negotiate. But, you know, all media outlets, be they print, be they online, are struggling with trying to make a penny at the moment, trying to turn a dollar. And no one has cracked the magic code as to how to do that yet in a way which is sustainable, in a way which is, you know, particularly going to maintain the scale of operations to which a lot of these, not just, you know, DNA Info and The Gothamist, which are relatively new publications, but particularly, you know, to the scale that the legacy publications have become accustomed. You're nodding vigorously, Faye. Do you want to jump in?
No, because I would like to come back to the fact that I was saying the problem with online advertising, because, you know, it's a very sad news, you know, that 115 jobs were lost, but DNA Info and Gothamist were losing money every single year since they've been launched. So clearly there's something was wrong on the business side of things. So I think the fact that they unionized, you know, it was just like the last thought. I was like, okay, this is not making money. I'll close down. So it's very sad news, but that's the problem with online. I think they have to find a better way to capitalize on their content, being with paywalls. But I think sometimes readers will have to pay. I think only free online advertising might not be the solution.
And this is the thing, how many of, I don't want to make presumptions about, you know, these people's lifestyles, but how many of the 115 people who lost their jobs pay for content? I imagine a relatively small number of them. And ultimately, the brutal economic reality as to why it's so difficult to make money in the media now is because people don't pay for content. Everyone expects to get everything free. And
it's changing. It will have to change.
Well, I'm not sure if it will change on the scale, which is Faye's adamant. Sorry.
Yeah, but you say that. But also, the other item of news that we're discussing right now, which is the closure of Teen Vogue's print issue version, comes at the same time as them saying that they're investing massively in their digital output because their digital output is growing so much. So I don't think you can make a sweeping case for all forms of digital output, because something like Teen Vogue has a specific readership quite clearly that perhaps is available to spend their money on collaterals digitally that they wouldn't necessarily do on print.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Chiara Ramella, Henry Ree Sheridan, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, or alternatively, just me doing three other voices, and perhaps not even me. Perhaps I'm not here at all. Perhaps it is all actually just Chris Lord doing four different voices. Coming up next, a celebration of the best 11 minutes of 2017.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York, or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me, Chiara Ramella, Henry Ree Sheridan, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, despite what would appear to be multiple violations of Twitter's terms of service, e.g. directing hatred towards named individuals and threatening violence up to and including the nuclear annihilation of entire nations, US President Donald Trump has never so much as had his account suspended. Until yesterday, when for 11 glorious minutes, users looking for Trump's latest semi-coherent blurt found only Twitter's error page. Twitter later explained that a contract worker had decided to mark their last day of employment by pulling the plug on the commander-in-chief. Chiara, first of all, do we like the chances of this teaching Donald Trump that perhaps Twitter isn't a secure platform on which he should be discussing matters of policy?
I'd like to think so, but I don't think it will at all. I mean, his first response to the thing was, that it was the proof of the fact that his tweets mattered and they were listened to, which is obviously the case because he is a president of the United States, and therefore him communicating directly via a medium is always going to draw an audience. I don't think he made an awful discovery there.
No, he has been making up today for that lost 11 minutes, among many other things, complaining about the verdict in the court-martial of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. He is insisting that the Department of Justice do what he tells them to do, which isn't actually how the Department of Justice works, and so on and so forth. Henry, that aside, he has also either recently or actually no, just recently, just in the last 24 hours, he has also demanded the death penalty for Saifullah Saipov. He's tried to pervert the course of justice by suborning the Justice Department, and he has used a racial slur towards Elizabeth Warren, though that has now been deleted. Seriously, should Twitter suspend him? These are multiple violations of its terms of use.
If he were a normal citizen, would they suspend him?
Yes.
Do you think they would?
Of course they would.
Of course, yes.
Well, I mean, in that case, yes. I think that he should be treated with the same, according to the same principles as any other Twitter user. Why do you think they have not suspended him?
Because he's the President of the United States.
Right. So
and because he, and even before that, because he was massive box office for them.
Do you think that's a calculation
on their part? I can't see what else it is.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that we should pay more attention to the disgruntled Winston Smith figure who did pull the trigger on this on his last day. Andrew, let's be honest. It's someone like you, isn't it? You would have done this.
And
probably will do this on your last day somewhere.
Sorry, do you all know something I don't?
But if his Twitter is indeed suspended, my only worry is that he might become a martyr, and he might say, "Oh, I've been censored by this."
How would we know?
do you know what I mean? I don't know. You know, of course, what he did is wrong, but I understand why Twitter also doesn't suspend his account. It is a difficult one to choose, actually.
Kiara, we have seen the representatives of various tech giants fronting congressional hearings this week in the U.S., which are trying to get to the bottom of to what extent they use their platform. They allowed their platforms to be used by Russian agents trying to screw up America's democratic process. Are they sufficiently accountable, or are they too powerful at this point?
I think they're very powerful. I don't think they're sufficiently accountable. The fact that they're very powerful is not necessarily a fault of their own. This is the way that the media has evolved. But I do think that, oh God, I think I'm about to quote Spider-Man here.
Oh.
Go on, this may be a first.
Yeah.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Well, indeed. I would like to introduce into the conversation what I think has been my favourite news story of the week, and which may serve as the defining metaphor for our era. And this was the revelation which has come from recent investigations that last year two fake Russian Facebook pages, that is, two Facebook pages purporting to represent organisations which do not exist, except in the imagination of some, you know, enterprising Yahoo at a Russian troll farm, succeeded in actually organising a fight outside an Islamic centre in Houston by getting two gangs of hillbillies so roused up on both sides of one particular cause that they were brawling in the street over literally nothing.
I mean, it's not funny, but it is funny.
It's definitely funny.
But I mean, I just want to jump in on this question of accountability, because I think that it does tie in to the media business dynamics that we were talking about earlier. These organisations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, that's where all of the capital that the media companies used to trade on, i.e. human attention, has gone. They have taken all of the business. They've taken all of the raw materials that they work with. But these companies are desperate not to be identified as media organisations, because then they know they'll be held accountable to the same standards, and they simply do not want the hassle of that happening.
Which would be monumental, trying to patrol and moderate that volume of content. My view is actually seriously tough luck. They are publishers, and they should be held accountable.
But I mean, it's far from certain that we would be able to hold them accountable if we wanted to, either.
But it would be their problem, wouldn't
it? Yeah, you'd have to create the structure. That would be their responsibility purely.
And this will create other worries as well about censorship on the internet as well, you know, so because at the same time that there will be, that we have to look at fake news and other problems, but I'm sure there'll be other examples where accidentally something that actually was correct will be censored. It is such a difficult grey area, and something that we will discuss, I'm sure, in the next 10 years non-stop.
Just a final thought on this one, Kiara. Is there ultimately anything that can be done about the real problem here, which is that people are dumb enough to believe everything they read?
by continuing to stress the importance of verification. I mean, I run the fact-checking here at Monocle Magazine, and I cannot tell you how painstaking that process is every single month.
I can tell you how painstaking that process is.
No, but what I mean is that that needs to become center, and media organizations need to be making it a point of pride that they need to be showing that that is what happens with every single one of their articles, and only those who do that are the media organizations that can be trusted.
Can I offer an alternative answer to your question?
Please.
No, nothing can be done about that.
Well, finally tonight, on a perhaps related story, Dolce & Gabbana, the makers of clothes worn by people who seem really keen for some reason to know, for you to know that their clothes were made by Dolce & Gabbana, have branched out into pasta in collaboration with
Pastificio Di Martino, I'll say it.
Thank you for leaping in there. I got suddenly suffused
that
with self-consciousness.
I like that.
Thank you. I got suddenly suffused with self-consciousness, so I was going to have to try and say something Italian in front of an Italian. They are going to release a limited run of 5,000 tins of pasta. These will come with a Dolce & Gabbana apron, and they will retail for $110 a go. Fernando, are you tempted?
Well, I'm not tempted, but I understand the pricing, and because, you know,
this is either going to be
incendiary opinion I've ever heard expressed in Midori House.
This is either going to be a hell of an apron or a hell of a tin of pasta.
I have to be honest, I was a bit shocked when I saw $110 for pasta. But then I checked, you know, it comes in a quite a cute tin. and there's some two packs of spaghetti, one of penne. And it comes with
there's
an apron as well.
Here.
No, there's no irony. And the thing is, people these days, you know what they do? They buy that and then they will sell for double the price.
Well, I think it's an issue of collectability, isn't it? Like, which is why it's strange.
Is pasta collectible?
But this is what I mean. It's like, obviously,
it is non-perishable.
It does perish in a very long time.
It doesn't need to have that then.
In a very, very, very long time. It takes years and years. But what I mean is, obviously,
That's good to know, given some of what's up the back of my cupboard. I won't starve this evening.
But what I mean is, obviously, it is a perishable item, but I think, you know, people pay incredible amounts for, you know, postage stamps. So perhaps if you consider pasta as a collectible, then you might as well pay $110 for it.
I just want to point out as well, this is a relatively coherent brand collaboration. Dolce & Gabbana, famous Italian brand. This pasta company, also apparently famous Italian brand.
I tried to pronounce it, Henry.
Yeah, I'm come not even, on. I'm not even
don't let my presence put you
off. I had a crack, come on.
But this is, you know, this is a relatively, don't blame me, this is a relatively coherent, as I was saying, collaboration. There are far less sensible collaborations all around the world from, I think, extremely sophisticated brands. And I think it's so interesting at this stage, deep in late capitalism, I hope anyway, that kind of so much can be asked of a consumer to accept tacitly without asking questions. The collaboration between, for example, the cream manufacturer Aesop and the Paris Review. For some reason, that makes sense, but there is no logical connection between those two products as physical objects. And I just think that whole, the kind of semiotics and psychology of that is so interesting.
I did want to ask, at the risk of the last 90 seconds of today's deliberation descending into a chair-hurling brawl, for some views on what is the best shape of pasta, that if we are going to sell this stuff for $110 a can, what shape should it be? And Chiara, obviously, we have to defer to you on this. What is the best sort of pasta?
Well, it really, really depends on what kind of pasta experience you want to have. This is serious.
This is going to get technical.
What are the tube ones called? The big cheese.
The tube ones.
You know what I want, though? No, they're in this tin, the big tubes.
Things have holes in them. Those are called bucatini, okay? Mm. But if you're referring to the item that holds the shape of pasta together, then I mean you can fill a tube-like container of pasta with many very different kinds of
pasta.
No,
I'm talking about the pastas are tubes. The actual pieces.
Are they short or long?
They're kind of short but wide.
Well, they could be paccheri if they're very,
that's
very
it.
Wide.
That's the one.
A paccheri is a very good shape of pasta. My personal favourite, I think, is probably tagliarini, just because my grandmother used to make them.
What do that look like?
Which ones are they?
So they're kind of a bit like tagliatelle, but thinner. So
okay.
The diameter, but you know what I mean. They're thinner.
Fernando?
I do like, I did some research. I like Strozzapreti because it's like a twisted tube. Is it? Sorry, okay. Sorry for my horrible way
don't
of describing
get me
this.
Started on the twisted pasta, okay?
Yes. You don't like twisted pasta?
Cannot bear fusilli. They are horrendous. They appear to be the kind of Italian pasta that the entirety of the world has adopted with enthusiasm.
Oh my
Every
God.
Single pasta salad, which in itself is an abhorrence.
I have to defend myself. I'm not talking about fusilli, just strozzapreti. I agree with you. There's too many twists on this one.
Guys, we're going to have to continue this conversation after the show. I have the suspicion that Chiara is capable of elaborating at some considerable length on this topic. I quite like the ones shaped like little shells. That is the end of today's show. Chiara Miller, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Henry Ree Sheridan, before that Chris Lord. Thank you all for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody.